This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. A group of REI employees were at Seattle City Hall earlier this week demanding secure scheduling practices and more hours. Part-time shift workers often don't know their schedule until a week or two before they have to clock in. Those unpredictable hours can make planning tricky. Could a smartphone help with that? A new app developed in Seattle hopes to give workers more power over their lives. It's called Shift, and it lets employees post when they need somebody to cover their hours or if they're looking for more. Dina Bass reported on Shift for Bloomberg News.
They get assigned to shifts in stores that are further from their home than they'd like. They have erratic hours, and sometimes they just don't get enough shift work to meet their financial needs or some other needs, to qualify for health care, or at Starbucks to qualify for their college degree program. You need a certain number of hours, and sometimes the workers don't get that, and so they want to trade. Or some workers will sometimes come across a shift that they just can't make. They've got a sick kid or a doctor's appointment.
So the idea is to make it easier for shift workers to schedule and plan their lives. Right now, if there are workers who are not using this app, like for instance at Starbucks, and they need to move a shift, what happens?
Right now, what goes on in a lot of stores is pretty old school. There's paper schedules at a lot of Starbucks that are posted in the back room, and so sometimes you don't even know what shifts you're working if you're not in the store. People have told me that, you know, they've asked other people at the Starbucks to take a picture of it and text it to them. And if you need to call around to switch with somebody, that can be a little complicated. And switching in between different Starbucks or different Old Navies definitely is required a phone call in many cases. You could call around to other stores and say, hey, we don't have anyone here who can cover this shift. Sometimes what I'm told is if a worker wants to pick up extra hours, they'll put a post-it note on the Starbucks schedule in the back room and say, hey, I can work on, you know, Wednesday and Thursday. I'm looking for some extra hours. So it's pretty paper-based and a little labor-intensive.
The old reliable post-it note. Well, how does Shift change that?
So it's basically a mobile app. You download the app, you put in which store you work at, it'll put you into that particular store's group, and again, the group for all of the stores in that region. And at that point, you could just exchange shifts with any of the people on those groups.
For workers who are using this app, it sounds like there's this whole new ecosystem among the employees that management is not involved in. How does this app change the relationship between workers and their bosses?
You know, it's an interesting thing. I think there's different layers of management at a lot of these companies. So, some of the baristas and the retail workers that we spoke to, actually their store manager had encouraged them to download the app or was using it. There were cases where store managers were posting the entire schedule on shift and just saying to the workers, look, go up on shift and tell me which shifts you can make. The bigger question, though, is how does the parent company, the corporate office, feel about it? And that may be a question. You know, these are companies that often employ their own software for scheduling. They control the schedules, and they may not necessarily want to give that up. A couple of the companies we spoke to declined to comment. We did speak to Starbucks, and, you know, they first of all told me they don't know any employees that are using it, even though Shift claims that they have baristas at, you know, one-third of the U.S. Starbucks outlets that have downloaded it. But Starbucks also said, look, you know, we make a lot of manual shift changes for people. We're flexible on that, and we really prefer that the individual baristas work with their managers on that rather than bringing in, you know, some sort of outside technology. But they also said they don't see a need for that. Right now they're handling it on a one-to-one basis, and they think that works.
How could this change the way workers plan their lives?
Well, I think it can give them some sort of greater measure of control if there is a shift that they can't do. If something comes up, they don't have to work as much. If managers really start posting the whole schedule and letting them select, that again gives them some more control. But, you know, one of the things regulators both in Seattle and to some extent New York and a couple of other cities have been talking about is whether there's a way to make shift work more predictable to a larger extent, maybe scheduling, a month out or giving people more regular shifts. Right now, this app can't do that. It doesn't change the way companies handle their scheduling writ large. The app can help, give individual people greater flexibility and help them reschedule things they can't make. It can't change corporate practices that are causing some of the issues potentially.
Scheduling shift workers and the number of hours they get, these are issues that have been coming up, as you mentioned, here in Seattle. Based on your reporting, Is erratic scheduling an issue shift workers need to solve for themselves, or is it an issue workers need to be protected from by policymakers?
I think it's hard to say. I think that's here in Seattle, what city council is discussing is whether, there need to be policies that ban certain practices or, make it difficult to engage in certain practices that make it harder for workers. What this particular app and this particular startup is trying to do is give some of the power and some of the flexibility back to the workers. But, I think it's really going to come down to regulators in different cities and states to decide whether there are practices from the company that they feel are problematic.
What kind of impact do you think this app will actually have?
I think it's very dependent on how many people they really get to use it. And you mentioned before corporate concerns. I mean, one of the potential concerns is whether companies block it. If a company decides that they want control over scheduling, do they say to their employees, look, you can't use this? Or tell their managers, we're not going to respect trades that are made on shift, that could really affect the impact that it has. For the company, the challenge is just getting enough people to use it where it really works and makes a difference. I mean, they had the CEO, Brett Petrontosh, told me that in the past 3 months, workers have exchanged about 2,600 hours on the app. But, right now, they have a rate of about 37% completion for a shift trade. So, meaning if you post a shift trade, 37% of the time you find someone to take it for you. A lot of their focus for the next year is going to be trying to get that percentage up quite a bit. They want to be at 60% to 80% in a year, because the app really only works if people are successful most of the time in brokering a successful trade.
Dina Bass is the Bloomberg News tech reporter. Well, malls run on shift workers, and malls are facing trouble everywhere. But if you've driven up 405 through Kirkland over the last 10 years or so, you'll know Totem Lake is in a category of its own. It's a bleached-out zombie, an undead mall with just a handful of businesses. People have been trying to bring it back for years. And as KUOW's economy reporter Carolyn Adolph explains, the mall is finally getting its big chance.
Totem Lake Mall was built in the 1970s. And it struggled through the 90s and into the next decade. Today, it is reduced to a few bank branches and a solitary Trader Joe's. All that is starting to change. Jackhammers employed by a California developer are ripping up acres of pavement.
It's happening. It's really happening.
This is Joe Rogoff of Whole Foods announcing that the grocery store had signed up to be a cornerstone of the new development, which will be a mixture of shops, gathering places, homes, and bike paths that will densify all this people-free space.
This is happening.
This is Kirkland's Deputy Mayor, Jay Arnold.
Totem Lake is really happening.
If people sound a little incredulous, it's because Totem Lake has been a hard problem to fix. Back in the day, Totem Lake had a modest department store named Lamont's. It struggled when bigger department stores in glamorous malls like Bellevue Square or Alderwood came along. There were redevelopment plans, but the Great Recession killed them off. Now reviews on the internet say things like, most depressing place I've ever been, and desolate concrete monument. Deputy Mayor Arnold says even people who worry about growth are in favor of the redevelopment of Totem Lake.
For a lot of people that are concerned about growth, Totem Lake is an area where people see the potential and say yes.
Totem Lake has a lake. It has a hospital, Highway 405, and lots of prosperous neighborhoods nearby. But that's not enough. Even malls with higher-end department stores are getting emptier. People's shopping habits are changing. There's the internet. Now developers think the solution is to turn the mall into a lifestyle, a place where you can not only shop, but also live, work, and get groceries.
Food is more difficult to shop for online.
This is Joe Rogoff of Whole Foods. He says despite the many grocery delivery services out there,
a lot of people want to look at that strawberry themselves.
And Totem Lake will have more than 800 places to live. Condos or apartments, that part isn't clear. But one thing is,
we're going for a little what we call a higher end or higher quality type product.
This is Rick Beeson, Vice President of CenterCal, the developer. He says techies and empty nesters are looking for convenient luxury living.
And we're trying to create an atmosphere where it's one step better than what's available elsewhere, and that's our goal.
Oh, that makes me kind of sad, actually.
This is Jennifer Whiteman, who hung out there as a teenager and has watched it decline.
I do love the mall.
And she wants to love the redevelopment, but...
this area has always been kind of middle class, working class, and putting a development like that in here, especially with really luxury apartments, I don't know, I feel like it's not really representative.
So even when people are not arguing over the need for redevelopment, having everything new and shiny doesn't always make everyone feel at home. In Kirkland, I'm Carolyn Adolph, KUOW News.
More on this story tomorrow on KUOW. It's part of our Region of Boom coverage. We have a form online where you can tell us about the changes you're seeing in your neighborhood. To see other stories and suggest ideas for future ones, go to KUOW.org and search for Region of Boom. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Kim Malcolm. The vast majority of money going into this year's initiative campaigns in Washington state has come in lumps of $10,000 or more, and it's come from a small number of wealthy individuals and special interests. That's according to a KUOW analysis. Here's our investigative reporter, John Ryan, with the story.
The initiatives heading for the ballot have been fueled by $14 million in campaign contributions so far. Labor union SEIU has been the biggest spender this year. The healthcare union has pumped $1.2 million into an initiative that would help fend off anti-union efforts from conservative activists. The measure would also increase the penalties for identity theft against seniors. An SEIU spokesperson did not respond to KUOW's interview requests for this story. Campaign contributions of that magnitude are much bigger than a candidate for office can take, but campaign finance limits don't apply to ballot initiatives. On initiatives, the sky is the limit, and it's not uncommon to see six-figure contributions. Tech entrepreneur Hadi Partovi of Bellevue gave $100,000 to a campaign finance initiative. It would limit political contributions and give voters $150 each to donate to candidates of their choice. It's similar to a clean elections measure that Seattle voters passed last year.
Americans believe in a government, you know, of the people, for the people, by the people. But our current system doesn't feel like it's doing that, and it feels like it's overly influenced by the influence of money in politics, and that the few have an outsized voice.
This initiative says it aims to reduce the corrupting influence of big money, and then you're giving big money to it. Does that seem at all odd to you?
It does, but the problem is we have the system we have. The only way to fix the system is within the system.
Partovi says there's a big difference between supporting a candidate and supporting an idea. A candidate can actually be corrupted. Connie Ballmer gave $500,000 to that Clean Elections initiative. She's married to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer. She declined to be interviewed, but the Clean Elections campaign issued a statement on her behalf, saying she is disheartened by the outsized role of money in politics. Her billionaire husband gave $500,000 to a gun control initiative. He did not respond to KUOW's interview requests. Venture capitalist Nick Hanauer also gave $500,000 to that gun control initiative. He gave another $500,000 to an effort to raise the state's minimum wage. Hanauer declined to be interviewed for this story as well. Big donors can often expect some financial benefit if their candidate or initiative wins. Hadi Partovi says there's zero personal benefit for him if the clean elections measure passes, other than an improved democracy. Reporting in Seattle, I'm John Ryan, KUOW News.
If you want to learn more of the secrets behind this year's big money initiatives, we've got them at KUOW.org. Hella Black, Hella Seattle is a new podcast. It's a summer special, runs till Labor Day. The women behind the podcast are Eula Scott Bino, Elena Caldwell, and Jasmine Jackson. They told Bill Radke about that name, Hella Black, Hella Seattle.
We knew the show was going to be really local, and we are three women of color, and we wanted to be inclusive, but we also wanted to like really spell out who we were before people tuned in and got the wrong idea. And we are all hella black and hella Seattle.
What would the wrong idea be?
If they just started hella Seattle and they tuned in and it was not people of color. because it could have been, right? And so the nice thing about having it be hella black to start off with was it lets you know from the gate who we are in terms of like where our viewpoint's going to be coming from as people of color. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
In my listening, it's not like you guys are talking about being black all the time. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, you're talking about shrimp pho and,
yeah.
you know, folk life versus Sundayata or what, just, you know,
yeah.
you're just talking. But there's a still a point of view, like you talk with the weed
yeah.
professionals, and it'll come up, you know, that, yeah, why is this a rich white thing? But
yeah.
But that's a small piece of it. Then you're just talking. I feel
right.
like maybe it's more your point of view affects who you're bringing to it.
Totally. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Totally.
Well, black people don't often just sit around and talk about being black.
yeah.
And that's also a misconception, right? So, yes, we have well-rounded lives and yeah, so it's really the point of view of being hella black. I'm still hella black even if I talk about shrimp pho.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't make me less black because I eat different things than cornbread and chitlins.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. So, and we're hella yeah. Seattle too.
Absolutely.
I mean, that's something that's really funny about the three of us is that, you know, if we go other places, when we go other places, people will stop and be like, you ain't from here.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, yeah, we're from Seattle. Oh, I knew you were from, what? I didn't know you guys were up there. Because we are so Seattle. I mean, we are just as Seattle as every other person we meet on the streets.
What does that mean? How can they tell you're not from here?
That we are from Seattle?
Yeah.
I think because we are, Seattle people are very outspoken and very witty, I think. I think that I always joke that we're rained in most of the year.
Mm.
And so, like, rainy day recess is a real thing if you grew up here, when we grew yeah. up here. And so, during recess, your only option was to sit around and talk and hopefully talk good right? like, so we know how to sit around and entertain ourselves.
Right.
And so I think all of that really translates into what makes us very Seattle. Also, we know nature in a way that most people don't.
Mm-hmm.
I tell this joke that my husband is from Boston and they would go to this like pond when they were in elementary school where they would fish. And, you know, the pond would be full of fish that they put there intentionally for the kids.
Yeah.
And I was like, but my elementary school, we went to the salmon hatchery and got salmon roe and took it back to school and watched it grow into be full
yeah,
salmon.
And
also we returned it.
Saw the salmon get killed, massacred.
I didn't
That's
see
like
that.
Oh my gosh. Are you for real?
No, at my we didn't go to the same elementary
it
school.
It was yeah. insanity. Yeah. I don't even understand how they were allowing that. Literally, it was just like a tank full of fish and they would pull a fish out
they'd
and
just slaughter it.
Yes.
I don't remember. Did you guys have roe too?
Bath.
Did you guys get salmon
yeah.
roe?
Yeah. And then they took okay. the roe and we were supposed to be happy after seeing the tragedy.
I blocked that out. That's my life. I block out so
Good
many
for
things.
You.
But yeah, so that makes us Seattle, mm-hmm. you know? I used to go on walks with my school to like Ravenna,
mm-hmm.
you know, like we are those things. We know this city mm-hmm. very well. And so we may be coming from a black perspective, but we've been living with, you know, everybody else forever.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have the numbers in Seattle. This isn't hella Atlanta, you know.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So what effect do you think that has on who you are, who your podcast is?
Yeah. Well, it's all we know.
Yeah.
So we've never been in a predominantly, more predominant than it is now, black city.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only like definition of we have as people of color in the city is what we have here. You know, the thing is, we are black people. All of our parents are black. All of our family right. is black. And we are from Seattle. So we've seen a large community our whole lives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's more spread out now, but it doesn't mean it's completely gone.
Right.
Are people of color losing an important concentration? You know, we all know about people are headed to Renton and Skyway. It should be hella Skyway. Hella Renton.
We ain't there yet.
Yeah.
No.
I think so. I mean, yeah, we've lost the concentration for damn sure. I tell the story about how growing up, I think this is true for all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Our families did not live in the same houses before we were born, right? So they moved around the city. And where they moved was always in the central.
Yes.
Right? Mm-hmm. So like our parents were like, I've lived in one house my whole life. Jasmine's lived in a few. Elena had one house probably your whole life, really, till this last year.
My whole life. Mm-hmm.
But before that, it wasn't like our parents were like, oh, this is it. They weren't born and raised there. They moved around the central district. That was it.
Yeah.
And right. so the nice thing about being younger in the city was, you, even if your best friend moved, they didn't move that far.
Right. Yeah.
And if you needed to get to a cousin's house, you probably were going to be able to walk.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Where now, it's funny because I know Elena can relate to this too. I can walk past homes and think, I don't speak to these people. If I do speak to them in passing, we maybe just say hello and goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been in your house, though.
Mm-hmm.
I've been in every crevice of your home. I probably had played hide and seek there.
Mm-hmm.
I probably like know what your backyard is laid out like. I might have even hurt myself in your home. it's just interesting to be like, yeah, I've probably been in your house, but we don't have that community at all mm-hmm. anymore for me to have that connection with you. I'll never do it again. My kids won't do it. Probably. Yeah.
So you want that community. Does that inspire this podcast?
Yes, definitely.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. We are so lucky to have each other.
Yes, mm-hmm. we are.
And we know it. We have times where we think if it wasn't for the, you know, all three of us still being planted here, we don't know what we would do in terms of how we would enjoy ourselves or where we would go. We would make new friends, but it wouldn't be the same, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
And when we hear people, we meet people all the time that are new to Seattle and don't know what to do mm-hmm. and are asking us for guidance. And for a very long time, I would hand out options,
yes. mm-hmm.
but it would never be enough to keep them, like, not to be good, right?
Yeah.
So now it's nice because it's like, oh no, I have a real option. Mm-hmm. I got a text from someone the other day that was like, oh, I'm so excited for your podcast. I heard about it. Oh, I wish this was here 6 years ago, you know, because he's been a transplant for 6 years, lost.
Mm-hmm.
So Yuli, you kind of led the way on the podcast, it sounds like.
Yeah.
You bothered them.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a degree in radio broadcasting, and I did not know what to do with it after I graduated, because it's a very hard field to get into. I always joke that if Diane Remain quitting, ain't no openings, right? And and so.
Well, you're in luck.
What?
She's leaving.
What?
Yeah, pretty soon.
Well, maybe then. Yeah. with her richity voice and just sticking on. So yeah, so I took a long time just trying to figure out where to plant myself, and was really trying to think of ideas for a podcast for a while, because I knew I wanted to do one, but I also know that, like, the forefront of my entire existence is wanting to make Seattle a better place for people of color. It's just all of our legacies are here. Everything our parents have done has been mm-hmm. impacted in Seattle, and, like, we want to do the same kind of thing. And so I sat long and hard on my honeymoon thinking about how to make it right, and came up with this whole entire thing in the sense of, like, oh, I know what Elena could do, and oh, I know what Jasmine could do, and I know it would work out great if we had interviews and we had to figure it all out. The only thing I didn't have was a name. And so I don't know. We came up with the name, all three of us, or did I come up with it?
I think you came up with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to do, like, Young, Gifted, and Black for Hella. And Marvin was like, no. My husband was like, that's not it. And I was like, I know, because I'm not that young anymore. And he was like, also, it's not that, like, cool. It's not that.
I mean, it's,
no,
know,
it is
not catchy.
So the how did you perfect. Sell Jazz and Elena on it?
It's funny because I was had this huge buildup where I was like, they're not going to do it. Only because we all have, like, really busy lives already. Mm-hmm. And we spend a lot of time together already. And so it's unique to say, hey, want to spend even more time with the people that you spend probably every weekend with. So now you're giving me Mondays mm-hmm. too. I was saying, I picked Jasmine up this morning. I was like, I haven't seen you in over a week. It's been forever.
A week.
Yes. So I was fearful of it. And so I sat down and I pitched it, and I had built myself up and talked my way into it. And their reaction was like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty simple.
And I cried because I was really happy.
You also found a way to kind of capitalize on what we were really good at and what we were already bringing to the table in terms of our friendship.
Yeah,
you know?
Mm-hmm. Totally.
Like, Eula's a talker.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
We always go to Elena for food reviews.
I'm just obsessed with food.
References.
So it made sense. And it was either this or actually do a blog, because they've been bothering me about that for forever. So, like, I'd rather just talk about some food than write up a whole thing.
Yeah.
It's too much.
And Jasmine knows everything that's going on the weekends.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm always like, let's go to this exhibit, or let's go to this party, or mm-hmm. I'm going to this festival.
Jasmine's like literally like subscribed to every single like feed in the entire city. Yeah. Like if the Sam is having something, it's in her inbox. Mm-hmm. If Fry is doing something, it's in her inbox. If there's a party going on, it's in her inbox. So she always knows what's going on anyways.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why you're all busy, you're all working.
Yeah.
Why is this worth your extra time? What's the ultimate satisfaction?
I think, well, first of all, I'm already going to be looking up Yelp reviews and going to new food places. So why not share that with other people, right? But then also, I think I was, like, really surprised about how many people are into it.
Yes.
And I think that drives me a lot. Like, this, just the response and people, like, loving it and being really excited for it, it makes me even more excited. So it's like this thing that we get to feed each other on, you know?
Mm-hmm. And we listen to podcasts, like we listen to The Read, which we really enjoy, yeah. which is a great podcast with people of color. Mm-hmm. But I think the big divide there is that everything that they experience or talk about is from a New York perspective. Mm-hmm. They live in New York. One of the main characters, main cast members is from Miami. The other's from Oklahoma. Those are not our stories. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when they talk about things or they share their hardships, we're like, all right, cool, but I ain't with it. Mm-hmm. And so it's really nice to have that opposite end of it being so local. I mean, you can find us. People yeah. who are like, oh, I hope I get to run into you someday. Yes. We're like, yeah, we'll be at this fantastic event on Saturday.
Come hang with us. Build yeah. with us.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
That's Eula Scott-Bino, Elena Caldwell, and Jasmine Jackson. They talked to KUOW's Bill Radke last month. You can find their podcast, Hella Black, Hella Seattle, on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It's The Record on KUOW. I'm Kim Malcolm. Skin color doesn't matter. That was a phrase Bothell pastor Drew Yost grew up hearing and believing. He was one of a handful of white players on his high school football team in South Carolina. His dad was a pastor and marched with the NAACP. And in church on Sundays, he and the rest of the largely white congregation would talk about how diversity is a gift from God. It wasn't until Yost was a seminary student himself that he started to realize that phrase, skin color doesn't matter, represented a real problem. But first, he had to come to grips with another new concept he heard about in seminary, that he benefited from white privilege.
I'd heard it before, but it's so closely associated with even like white supremacy that it seemed irrelevant, only for super racists, maybe, you could say.
Right, you're thinking, I'm not a white supremacist.
Absolutely, and I was struck by this, I was being attacked, right? And I remember feeling this, almost this burning sensation, and it took me so long to I even went and talked with the director of the seminar afterwards and said, what was that about? You know, I have a voice to contribute, and it's a positive voice. I'm on your side here. And it took me a while to figure out exactly what it was that was causing this visceral reaction.
Why do you think you felt angry and so frustrated after that experience?
I think the anger stemmed from a place of feeling like I had something positive to contribute and that wasn't being heard, that, you know, that I'm not a racist. In fact, I went to a predominantly black high school and been in predominantly black neighborhoods and grew up in a state that is largely black and largely black communities. And I have a positive voice to say, and yet it sounded like, well, you're white, so you don't get to contribute to the conversation in the way you want to. And that was a really difficult thing to hear. I wasn't ready to hear that at the time. And it took me a while before I was able to really understand even what those words meant.
What happened as you absorbed that message? What kinds of changes did you go through?
Well, initially, I feel like when we're confronted with these notions of privilege, systemic racism, power, for the first time, some of the reaction tends to be just to kind of to put up a wall and say, that's not me, I'm not racist, and that's the end of it. For me, it stems some curiosity because clearly other people around me believe this, and people I trusted, people I valued, and I have this call to faith. I have this trust in Jesus and that was really important to me. That really encouraged me to dig deeper. And for the next 3 years in seminary, I took anti-racism training. I took classes on race and culture and privilege. I took a class on mass incarceration. I had conversations with different people in different community groups. And I read great theologians, black theologians, James Cone, Kelly Brown Douglas, that really helped form me to talk about race in completely new ways than I'd ever been used to before. Rather than saying, I want to be a leading voice, it was saying, how can I support others and having a voice in this? And even a sense of fear and vulnerability. I mean, to be an advocate for anti-racism, to use words like white privilege, white supremacy, is a challenging thing. And it means putting your voice out there in a way that not everyone is very comfortable with, especially not in the white church. And that's going to be rejected in a lot of places, including probably a lot in my home state of South Carolina. So it involved kind of seeking some new paths for me, some listening and trying to figure out where exactly I thought the Holy Spirit was trying to take me.
You had this first experience while you were at seminary, and you've told our producer that you feel like many white Christian churches minimize the real issues around race and racism. What did you mean by that?
I think when I was talking to your producer, I said that the white church is kind of stuck in this all lives matter theology, or it's even people using phrases like, we're all children of God. Skin color doesn't matter. You know, diversity is a gift. And yet, then we retreat to our white churches where we all look the same, where we sing the same songs, where we appreciate the same structures, where we have our youth groups and our children's pageants and our Sunday schools. And it doesn't reflect that. It's not the same. You can't say that all lives matter and that diversity is a gift from God, and then go to a church where everyone looks the same as you and appreciates the same thing as you. And I think it's this, we're steeped in this sense of protecting ourselves and our institutions and the things that have meant so much to us at the expense of really, truly being welcome. I mean, I can think of so many churches that put out front, all are welcome, and everyone is a member here. Everyone is welcome here. And yet, you go inside, and people don't see other people like them. They don't hear songs that they appreciate. They don't see structures that conform to who they are and leadership who they are. They don't see people in leading who look like them. And all of a sudden, you start to see this isn't what we're called to do. The theology of we're all a gift from God, skin color doesn't matter, just doesn't cut it anymore in a Christian voice. It doesn't call us out of our own systems that we're perpetuating. My wife and I are called out here to start a new church that's hopefully free of some of the systems and structures of racism that is inherent in almost every form of white church out there.
So what is that going to look like?
We're waiting to see what that's going to look like. We're only about a month into it out here. And one of the difficulties that we're facing, that I'm facing personally, is that I'm white. And trying to start a church that is inherently anti-racist, that resists some of the structures, I understand the challenge that's going to be for me. And my wife is Japanese-American, is going to be still a challenge for both of us, that we need to create partnerships with the community around us. We need to listen to the voices, especially the voices of the people who are less often heard in the community. We want to encourage conversations like this, but also participate in different advocacy groups that are around here. And we're still just at the start of learning what's going on in Bothell, Mill Creek, North Creek area that we can be a part of. What's going on in the community? What do the conversations sound like? Are there even conversations around this kind of thing? And if there's not, how can we help start that? And ultimately, how can a church begin at its very foundations resisting some of the structures of racism through whatever worship and community and service life that happens?
You mentioned foundations, and you are the new pastor in town in the Bothell Mill Creek area with some new ideas. What's your sense of how willing your flock will be to engage in this kind of work?
That's a great question. We are still getting a sense of who our neighbors are in this area. We have seen the demographics. We know that it's a culturally diverse area. We know that it's a generationally diverse area, and we have to be willing to have these conversations with every person we meet. And we also have to be willing to develop relationships with people we meet. If there are those certainly Christians in this area who are unwilling to engage in these conversations, then I think we need to wrestle with our theology. What is God doing? What does it mean to say we worship Jesus here if we're not willing to engage in these conversations about race and skin color? I mean, we can talk on a practical level about what to do right now, but we also need to talk on a theological level inside our churches. What are we even saying when we preach, when we sing, when we pray, that will affect real change in this place, in this small community, North Creek, in the wider Seattle community, and in the country?
Drew, our conversations around race relations and our communities have been quite politicized over the years, and those can be some pretty murky waters for religious communities to wade into. How do you plan to thread the needle on that?
political just means how we negotiate life together. The whole Bible, the whole story of God and the world is about how we negotiate life with one another and life with God. What is our relationship with God? What is our relationship with our neighbors? There is something inherently political about the message of Christ, and not to be a negative word, to be a positive word. When we study the Bible, when we study these great theologians, that all of a sudden the kind of easy theology of Jesus will make everything great again isn't enough. It isn't enough to hold ground in these conversations that we're having. But if we start talking about things like incarnation, about God becoming flesh, it's right there in the Gospel of John, the Word became flesh. What a great time to talk about race if we're talking about flesh in our world. We're talking about Jesus living life under an oppressive empire and being murdered by the state. And it's all so relevant, the Bible, theology, and the conversations we have with our neighbors. My hope is that Christianity has a distinct voice to add to this conversation that we're having nationally about race, but also about life, and that we can't shy away from that. We can't come away with it with easy answers, and that to be a disciple and a follower of Christ requires some depth.
Drew Yos is a pastor at Light of the Cross Lutheran Church in Bothell. He's also starting a new church with his wife. He wrote an opinion piece in the Seattle Times earlier this month about how white Christians need to reframe how they think and talk about race. We're tweeting out a link to that piece now.